Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast, the podcast where we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope that it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors of sexual abuse too. We hope that you find it interesting, but more than that, if you are a survivor of sexual abuse, we hope that you find our discussion empowering.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Alan Collins, and I'm joined today by an acquaintance, an old friend from Jersey, Mike Dunn. Hello, Mike.
Yes, hi there.
And I think it's fair to say, Mike, that you have strong views on human rights issues. You're a historian, very much interested in legal issues, and bring it all together. And in a previous podcast, we spoke about piracy and human rights. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about human rights today, and in particular about the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child. And I think that's something you're particularly interested in. And perhaps by a little bit of an intro, perhaps you can explain to our podcast listeners why, Mike, you're interested in the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child.
Well, it's a bit of a perverse interest, really, because, I mean, I've read it, obviously, but I haven't seen how they're going to apply it. Now, the United Nations are showing an interest at the moment, and there is a report going out from the Children's Commissioner. We have got now a commissioner, which came as a result of abuse to children in Jersey. There was a report, as you know, the Care Commission, and one of the recommendations that came down the line from that was that they should ratify this Convention on the Rights of the Child. But I have a slight problem with it, because I think the European Convention of Human Rights, if that had been followed, it wouldn't be necessary, because there's enough articles in the European Convention of Human Rights to deal with most of the issues that arise. However, there's a separate one. They've made a separate convention on children's rights, and it's all well and good, but I think it tends to confuse the issue. It's something else which is people have got to tick the boxes. It provides work for a few people, but I'm not convinced. And strangely enough, one of the speakers, because I was organising a human rights conference this year, of course, the virus paid to that. I was going to have some speakers. We're going to have a couple of days specifically talking about the convention and the children's rights and matters related to family rights and so on and so on. And I was going to have a speaker who I brought over here 25 years ago, and she's been very prominent in children's rights. Now, she had written one of the first books on the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the big red book. But I understand I can't speak for her, so I'm not naming her. But she's sort of rather gone off the convention and sort of come to a conclusion that I've sort of come to, without much knowledge, I hasten to add, that it's not really very effective. It doesn't deliver the goods. Now, I'm hoping the Children's Commissioner here will prove me wrong, but we do in Jersey have a Children's Commissioner, we do have a Children's Minister, and we have a Children's Rights Officer. Now, I rather think there's a lot of people that supposedly have a duty to do something, but in fact, at the end of the day, they don't. I think the Children's Commissioner will, because I think she's keen to do something. She's also an ex-policeman, as I understand, police officer. So I think she has a thinking process, which is probably about enforcement. But I suspect that when it comes to the crunch, she won't be able to make it effective. I suspect. But it's early days for Jersey. It's early days.
Well, there's a lot there, Mike. So Scotland, I noticed, you know, the devolved government up in Edinburgh is looking at incorporating the convention into Scottish law, and Scotland has its own legal system, of course, and a bill, I understand, is going before the devolved parliament in Edinburgh to give effect to the convention so that it becomes something of Scottish law. Now, England and Wales, UK parliament has signed up to convention but has not incorporated it into English law, the argument being, well, it's not necessary. But I think it is necessary, and I think it's necessary if one accepts that we do not ask the right questions. I think we look at the convention when it comes to children as giving children rights. But the problem is, and I think this is where I would agree with you, is that children are dependent on adults exercising the rights for them. And what we should be saying is, well, actually, this needs to be looked at from the eyes of a child. Children shouldn't be the sort of bolt-on. The convention isn't for adults, it's for children. And I think whether it's the UN or whether it's governments, they should be asking the question, well, what does it actually mean for children? If we're giving rights to children that are going to be enforceable in law, how are children meant to exercise those rights? They're children, they're vulnerable. A child can't just wander off to the local court aged 6, 7, or 8 and say, I want to make a complaint, I want to do something or whatever, or fill out a form or whatever. And, you know, these conventions and laws are all framed from an adult perspective. And I think that's the mistake. And I think it all comes down to the fact that we don't ask the right questions. We should be asking, and it's difficult, and I don't pretend that I necessarily have the answers. We should be asking, okay, what does it actually mean for the child? What does it mean for a child who is vulnerable and perhaps is being abused? How do they exercise
those? That's a valid observation, but I think your readers will need to know that you are a lawyer from the UK. You're not a Jersey lawyer. And the Jersey lawyers have done remarkably little to enforce the rights of the child here over the years, traditionally. That's why you exist in Jersey at all, because they've been negligent. That's my view. And the other thing is, the Children's Commissioner is very keen on promoting the children's knowledge and awareness. And the literature she does is very much designed for children. And I think that is it's not a problem as far as the children are concerned, but it is a problem as far as the adults are concerned, because adults are looking at this stuff and say, oh, this is for children, it's not for me. Now, I don't know why. For example, when a territory signs up for a convention, it's supposed to publish it. Now, they haven't made a copy of that convention available to every household in the island. And when those children go home and say, I know my rights, and the parent says, oh, I'll flip you around the ear because you're not going to do as you're told, that's the sort of traditional. And if the parents' knowledge isn't brought up to speed as well, how the children actually get their access to legal protection, I don't know. It's not going to be an automatic, for Jersey especially, which is a very old-fashioned reactionary place, such things do not come easily. And that's part of, it's been negligent, as you well know. The negligence is very deep-seated here about the whole process. So putting a convention and say, here you are, children, get on with it, that's not the one. You've got to get the people, the whole population. And there are other aspects too. For example, the population of Jersey, for your readers, about 110,000. It's gone up rapidly. When I first came here in the 60s, it was about 60,000. It's now 110,000. A lot of people here, 15,000 working adults, are immigrants without housing qualifications. Now, the Children's Commissioner has latched onto this, that the Housing Commission conditions of so many children, for example, there's a lot of children involved in those 15,000 people. That's part and parcel of the problem, the immigrant children especially. Now, Jersey's not going to let go of that control over housing. These are the sort of discriminations which are built into the system, and they're very much what a lot of people here think about keeping people out, all those prejudices which we get. Now, unless somebody is very, very active, very proactive, that sort of feeling is not going to go away.
Well, this is where you get down to, you know, the practical issues and the law of unintended consequences. And this is why maybe some governments are shy from incorporating the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child into their domestic law, because it has implications and it can result in governments and state bodies being held accountable. But I think you have to look at the bigger picture. So Sweden, for example, has recently incorporated the convention into its law, so that will have legal implications in Sweden. So the Swedes are looking at the big picture. So Sweden obviously is very different to Jersey geographically, of course, but relatively speaking, a smallish population with its own issues and so on. But it's looked at, as I said, the bigger picture, and realizes that the convention does mean something. And it does mean that it's an opportunity to drive up standards and to drive down the risk of child abuse, because that's what it's all about. And it's about making sure that laws and procedures and policies do not ignore the rights of the child. So when you're drafting a policy which may impact on the child, you have to ask the question, well, how is a child going to see this? How is a child going to be affected by it? How is the child's voice going to be heard? It says housing. So you picked on housing, a very good and controversial issue. Housing is a big issue all around the world, isn't it? And it's not just Jersey, it's the UK, it's everywhere. So if you have a housing law that discriminates maybe for good reasons. You know, I'm not saying that all discrimination is necessarily bad. You know, there may be an example where there has to be some kind of restriction. But if you're going to have a restriction, you have to ask the question, well, we're going to have a restriction on rights to housing. How is that going to meet up to the standards of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child? Because if you say a particular adult can't have a house, can't buy a house, can't settle, but that person's child was born, say, in a particular country, whether it's Jersey, England, Scotland, Sweden, wherever, you are, by implication, going to be interfering with that child's rights. You might be interfering with that child's right to nationality, residence, education, health, whatever it happens to be. That's the challenge.
Those are issues. That's a live issue at the moment. The other thing your readers will have to know is that a little place like Jersey still hasn't ratified the Convention of the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So there's half the population straight away are not. The rest of the world seems to think that that's an important convention. It is about to be ratified, so we understand, but the right of individual petition for women to make use of it, it'll just be a piece of wallpaper. That's all it'll be. Say, oh, we've signed up for it, but it won't be effective. This will be the trouble. They haven't done it yet, but they still haven't done it. Your readers should know that to get the full picture.
Talking about some religions in the West which discriminate against women. Women are not allowed to take part in sort of senior positions in particular religions and churches. And you may say, oh, well, you know, that's down to them, that's down to their particular religion. But that is a very sort of narrow, parochial, paternalistic view, because when it comes to children, women, of course, can have a fundamental role to play when it comes to child protection and safekeeping. So if you have an unbalanced hierarchical structure in your particular church or religion, you are running a risk that you may not be meeting up to your child protection requirements, because why would it be that only the voice of a man should be heard when it comes to child protection? Why should it be just men only? Don't women have a say in child protection? Of course they do. So these conventions, these potential laws, do have wide-ranging implications. And not necessarily negative ones, but positive ones. And since we're talking about children and the rights of the child and ensuring that children are protected, if you discriminate against certain adults because of their sex or their faith or whatever it happens to be, you are running a huge risk that you are going to be failing the fundamental needs of a child.
I mean, even though Jersey and Guernsey to some extent haven't ratified all these conventions, your government, the United Kingdom government, is fairly seriously considering revoking some of these conventions and having a Bill of Rights. Now, the effect of that on these territories is totally unknown, because we simply don't know what would happen, because the outside supervision, for however inadequate it is now, like the United Nations are looking at children's rights here now, and there is a study going on, and a group children's commissioner is going to Geneva. She's taking a party of children. But there are no effective NGOs in Jersey to go with her. They're finding some people to go with her. But you can see that if your government, the United Kingdom government, starts to revoke international conventions, they won't be able to revoke them automatically for Jersey and Guernsey insofar as they exist. So these are very big questions as far as these islands are concerned.
Indeed. Well, you know, I'm somewhat of a sceptic when it comes to the UK government saying that it's going to roll back and have a Bill of Rights and so on. Personally, I can't see that happening at all, and certainly wouldn't be happening anytime soon. I suspect the UK government's got enough on its plate as it is. But let's say, for argument's sake, that was a serious consideration. The problem is, of course, is that UK governments have been going around the world signing up to treaties and conventions. And it's going to be a bit of a pragmatic headache to start to unpick treaties and conventions that have been signed up to, you know, going back to, you know, the creation of the UN.
About the role of lawyers in all this, because when I first got interested in human rights years ago, I used to go to conferences in the UK and I could understand what they were talking about. When they incorporated the European Convention into English law in 1990 or 1999 or 2000, it became part of the law. All of a sudden, the standard of awareness, the standard of discussion became above my ability to. The lawyers grabbed it because there was work there. That's what happened. It became a subject they could use. And there are lots of cases, quote, the European Convention of Human Rights, even if they don't commit, I don't know how many cases, quote, the Convention on the Rights of the Child in the UK. I don't know. That was something you will know about. But generally speaking, what's your feeling about lawyers? I mean, you've met the Jersey lawyers. I mean, I can only say ill of the Jersey lawyers for the most part. You've met them. Is there something different about Jersey lawyers that they don't seem to be aware? Why are you interested? What motivates you and other English lawyers or British lawyers? Because obviously there is a percentage who are interested, aren't there?
Well, that's an interesting big question. I suppose, to be frank, I didn't say one morning, oh, yeah, let's get involved in these cases, let's get involved in this work or so on. It just happens because someone just came to me for advice on a particular issue and it concerns Jersey and it just evolved from there. And all the time people sort of knock on my door and ask me questions about their particular cases, I'll do whatever I can to try and assist them to the best of my ability, or trying to the best of my ability. Sometimes it's I find that my ability is somewhat lacking, but I try and do my best. So yes, it's there, and I think as time goes by, people become more aware. I suspect the vast majority of the population of the world has probably never heard of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, but it starts to pop up in the news. As I said, in Scotland, there's now a bill that's going to go before the devolved parliament in Edinburgh on this. And so people will, with time, become more aware. Whether it's going to make a big difference or not to the lives of children, well, that's another question. It's a profound question. And I think it all goes back to those in a position to have some kind of influence, asking the right questions. Otherwise, it becomes, as you said right at the beginning of this podcast, a tick box exercise which serves no one and actually creates problems down the road when problems emerge.
You sat through a great deal of the inquiry that took place, the child inquiry here that took place here, and there was years and years and years of people being trained in the UK. They had the theoretical knowledge about laws that applied for the protection of children, but when they came here, they seemed to disappear out of their brain. I don't know where it all went. They did not apply it. So they've been trained.
Jersey is not an isolated example of that. It happens elsewhere, and it's because there seems to be a disconnect between laws being passed and implemented and actually carrying out those sort of legal obligations on the ground, often in very, very difficult circumstances. You know, children's officers and social workers have to work in very often in unpalatable and very difficult circumstances. It's difficult work. But you do see time and time again, sadly, when things badly go wrong, poor management, poor supervision. You know, the same themes do emerge time and time again. And again, this is where the convention perhaps is of great importance. Many children who have given evidence, whether in the Jersey inquiry or the UK inquiries, would say, well, we were treated as second-class citizens. We were thought of as second-class citizens.
But they weren't like you. You were a UK lawyer and you actually pointed out some very specific defects from a human rights point of view to the commissioners. But I don't think I can remember any Jersey lawyers doing that. Why not?
You'd have to go and ask them. So, you know,
I'm trying to find out what motivates you. Why are you different? Why?
Well, because I think if you can make a tiny little bit of difference in a positive way, then that, as a lawyer, you should strive to do. That's what motivates me. If you can say, yeah, I did make that person's life a little bit better as a result of them crossing my path, then I think that's, at a human level and at a professional level, that is very worthwhile. That's very rewarding. And, you know, if people come to me for advice, assistance, I will do my best to try and help them. So that's how I became involved in Jersey and all the various cases that we've had over the years and how I became involved in the inquiry and everything that entailed and so on. So, yeah, I can only answer that question from my own perspective. I can't speak on behalf of...
You're still active here. Yeah. And as you know, you haven't been replaced by anybody local, or and I don't know whether your firm will replace you when you do come and retire. I don't know if you will ever retire, or like a good lawyer, you go on forever and ever. But what would Jersey do without you? I mean, that's my worry. It is a genuine worry.
Well, there might be some who would be clapped their hands with glee.
They would.
But anyway, but seriously, no, it's, I think I always think that there are opportunities, big opportunities, whether it's Jersey or the UK or anywhere else, that can be seized to try and reduce the risk of abuse. You know, the tools are there, the knowledge is there, and it's all about whether those in power are prepared to devote the time and energy to make the most of those opportunities. They're there. It comes down to, I think, in many cases, to political and professional will. It's all terribly difficult. You know, it's unpleasant stuff. It's difficult. But if you don't deal with it, it becomes corrosive, as we know, in the UK, as well as Jersey and Australia and Ireland and Canada and the States where, you know, abuse has been uncovered on a large scale, and you find that it has been so corrosive. It touches everything. It undermines everything. It undermines confidence in the police, social services, government, the civil service, everything. Everything that ought to be secure and safe. We find, sadly, that child abuse doesn't just affect the individuals, you know, the children and their families. It affects all levels of society in varying ways. And, you know, we've seen that so many times. And the tools are there to try and avoid history repeating itself. It can be done, but it requires professional and political will. And you don't need loads and loads of laws and new conventions and all the rest of it. You know, it's already there. It's about...
I think it's already there.
It's already there. It's about going beyond, say, oh, yes, we've got this new law. And, you know, you tick a few boxes, like you were saying. It's more fundamental than that. It's instilling a new sort of level of discipline in all levels of society, so that society at all levels accepts its responsibilities. That's what I think.
Really? Well, I went to a meeting yesterday, a launching of the new disability discrimination regulations. As far as I know, there wasn't a single member of the government there. I don't think there was a Jersey lawyer there. There was a few members there, a few care workers, I would think, there. There was a couple of dozen people there. And I thought, it's pretty disgusting, really, isn't it? Something, there are 30,000 people affected. They're not all disabled persons in Jersey, but there are about 30,000 people affected. They're carers, they got some in their families, so it affects them. There are a lot of people with disabilities. And that's the sort of level of interest. And obviously, it's because it's buildings are going to have to be altered, ways of work are going to have to be, you know, adaptations, all that sort of stuff which is coming. Now, the similar sort of thing happened after the care inquiry. There was lots of meetings, as you know. You attended loads and loads of them. You gave your time. And other people, I gave my time. There's a gentleman sitting behind me who gave hours and hours and hours of his time. But very few did. Why? Why? I can't reconcile why some people, so many people, just don't give a damn.
Well, people are very busy, and there's often a disconnect because people often think, well, actually, it's got nothing to do with me, which comes back to the effects of child abuse in society being so corrosive because it affects everything. And people don't realise that until after the event, when they find that confidence in public services has been undermined, whether it's confidence in the police or whatever it happens to be, has been undermined. And then, of course, it's all too late. It comes down to professional and political leadership. As I said, you know, it comes back, you can have all these policies and laws and all the rest of it, but actually they've got to mean something. They've got to mean something at a very sort of practical level. So, you know, we had coronavirus, haven't we? You know, we're still living with that, and the entire population had to engage with various measures because it was communicated as such. There was that level of communication where everyone understood they were affected. Got to wear a mask, can't go there, got to stay indoors, can't go to work, can't do this.
Very interesting human rights implications of all that.
Well, we'll talk about that in the next podcast. So, Mike, on that profound note, thank you very much. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favourite podcast player. If you'd like to speak to us about something you've heard today, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.